On This Week in Enterprise Tech, database time bombs, T-Mobile wins the spectrum race, and VMware thinks VDI is on the horizon. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 235, recorded April 14, 2017. Virtual desktop infrastructure with VMware Horizon. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open source, you can download it and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. Welcome to Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise, but I cannot guide you by myself. It's an awfully big world, and I'm going to need the help of my friends, starting with Mr. Lou Maresca. He's a senior lead developer at Microsoft. Lou, how are things going on up in the Redmond area?
Doing great. Yeah, doing real well. We're getting ready for builds coming up in a month and just getting ready to release some cool stuff. So we're busy, busy, busy.
I'm so sad because I got several email confirmations from the different build representatives that I've been dealing with. I'm like, oh, we're so excited to have you. And I have to write them back. I can't go. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. But at least they promised to keep sending me all the briefings. So yeah, that's my bad. But someone who is definitely not bad is Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are things on the other side of the country?
Padre, it's another beautiful day here in the swamp. The spring breakers are coming and going. I had the day off, and hey, life is good.
Well, gentlemen, we've got one heck of a show planned for our audience. Not only are we going to be going over the news of the week, but we've got a representative from VMware. That's right. He's going to be on to talk all about VDI, what it can do for you, and why you need it. But first, let's jump into the blips. Now, are you one of those IT guys who has grand notions of what you could do to your company's network if they don't treat you right? If so, communicate with your superiors, make a case for your promotion, and maybe, just maybe, shop around to see if your talents can be better rewarded elsewhere. Anything but what a former Allegro Microsystem employee is accused of doing to his former network. Nimish Patel, working in the IT department for Allegro for 14 years before he resigned in January of 2016, left the company and took three laptops with him. One that was given to him for personal use, and two that were set up to access the network. HR contacted Patel to ask him to return the two work laptops, telling him that he could keep the personal laptop. Instead, he returned one work laptop and the personal laptop wiped clean. 2 weeks later, it is alleged, he parked close enough to the building to gain access to a Wi-Fi AP, then used the remaining work laptop and a former co-worker's credentials to access the Allegro network. He's accused of then planting code in the Oracle database financial module that would take effect on April 1st, 2016. When the code executed, it copied headers and pointers into separate databases, then purged the original data, breaking the finance module. Allegro's investigation tracked the malicious code back to a login with the MAC address of the unreturned work laptop and several unspecified digital fingerprints. Allegro is claiming more than $100,000 in damage and is seeking reparations and possible civil penalties for Patel.
Vault 7 attacks just keep hitting the wild. That loud sound you just heard over in the cybersecurity world, well, that's the sound of the other foot falling. After WikiLeaks released information on CIA hacking software that was released into the world, it was only a matter of time before that software started showing up in security scans. And that time, it appears, is now. According to a Symantec blog post on April 10, a group called Longhorn has used the CIA tools against at least 40 different targets in 16 countries since the release. Now, Longhorn is Symantec's name for a group of hackers that the company's researchers have been following for some time. Describing the group as well-funded, highly expert, and English-speaking, Symantec has pulled up short of saying that Longhorn is a client of or represents the CIA. But the group's espionage-oriented software and attacks seem to point in that direction. Among the reasons for the description, well, on one occasion, a computer in the United States was compromised, but following infection, an uninstaller was launched within hours. All the other targets of Longhorn have been in Europe, the Middle East, Asia, and Africa.
So what would you do for 10,000 Bitcoins or roughly $8.2 million? Well, back in January, the renowned hacker group Shadow Brokers offered to dump their entire cache of NSA hacking tools for a bit of coin. As part of the offer, they gave a bit of a tease on those tools by dumping 300 megabytes of files that contain a bunch of exploits and tools by the Tailored Access Operations Unit, which is basically the NSA's elite hacking group. Then they went dark. Well, they're back again, and here to show you just how much data they actually have. The Shadow Brokers dumped almost 300 gigabytes of material, tools, and exploits, which target the Windows operating systems, including Windows 8 and Windows 2012, as well as the infamous Swift banking system service bureaus around the world. Many independent security firms have confirmed all of this, and they've noticed that even though it's very substantial cache of exploits, the dump itself is far from actually being from complete. There are such things as the internal blue tools, which exploits a remote code execution bug in the latest version of Windows 2008 R2, using the server's message block and NetBT protocols. There's also something called Eternal Energy, which is an SMB version 3 remote code execution flaw for Windows 8 and Server 2012. Microsoft has already responded by saying, "We are reviewing the report, and we are taking the necessary actions to protect our customers." The timing is actually a pretty interesting one, since some of the areas around the world observe a long weekend this week. And it could include all sorts of juvenile hackers, such as script kiddies, being active over the holiday weekend. So the files are also suggest that the NSA is actively targeting the IB, or the International Bank Bureaus, specifically through widespread global protocol for secure financial messaging and transactions. So even though it looks to be used to expose financial data for terrorists, it could be more dangerous than for other people's funds overseas as well. Do yourself a favor. If you have a system that's affected, might want to take and think about upgrading this weekend.
Now, last Friday night, a curious thing happened in Dallas. 156 emergency sirens, the type that are used to warn the public of imminent danger from tornadoes and other weather emergencies, were activated late at night, going through 15 90-second alert cycles. But there was no weather emergency, and the sirens were not activated by the city. In fact, the city entirely lost control of the system and had to resort to the tried and true method of turning it off and back on again. Sana Syed, the director of the City of Dallas's Public Information Office, was quick to call the event a hack, but what we've learned about the system since then has shown that it's not that simple. The system isn't a typical network-connected system, connected by fiber, copper, and common networking protocols. Rather, it's a wireless receiver system, and the hack was actually just the broadcasting of certain tones over the airwaves. The enterprise story here is that the system provided by Federal Signal Corp was maintained by West Shore Services, and it didn't do anything wrong. It will be difficult to lock down because the weakness that was exploited, namely that it was relatively easy to trigger the system, is exactly what it was designed to do. The technology used to warn of and inform after disaster needs to be disaster resistant. That means not locking it down with complicated authentication and tying it to a network that will most likely be disabled in the wake of a disaster. Still, a good case study for those looking at the utility security equation.
Rancher might be the container Linux you've been looking for. Rancher Labs is announcing general availability for Rancher OS, the stripped-down version of Linux that the company uses with its own container management platform. The container management platform, called Rancher, is what the startup is best known for, and it doesn't even have to run on Rancher OS. It can run on any variety of Linux. But the company has found that the minimalism of Rancher OS appeals to customers. The company has had paying customers for the OS for a little less than a year, according to CEO Sheng Liang. Rancher OS leaves out everything in Linux user space. That is, all the code that's not running in the Linux kernel itself. Anything that's not in the kernel gets put into a container running on the kernel. Rancher provides a few of these containers. One runs DHCP, for instance, as part of the Rancher OS product.
So it looks like Microsoft is taking some additional steps to try and get people to move to their latest Windows 10 operating system in order to take advantage of some of the latest processors and their capabilities. So according to a recent report, users with Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 PCs with a Kaby Lake and Ryzen processors are being blocked from receiving updates. This looks to include not only feature fixes, but security updates as well. Microsoft did state last year that it would restrict the latest Intel Kaby Lake and AMD Ryzen silicon to Windows 10. Enthusiasts are wondering what would happen if they tried to run those PCs also using Windows 7 or Windows 8. So now we know. No new patches. The motivation for this move is to ensure the latest processors from silicon manufacturers would be taking full advantage of what Windows 10's code base has to offer. If you want the latest and greatest, it may be time to upgrade.
The off-delayed FCC auction of the 70 megahertz of bandwidth in the 700 megahertz range, repurposed from television use, has raised $19.8 billion. $10.1 billion of that will be split between the 175 TV stations who parted with their allotted spectrum, while $7.3 billion will go to the U.S. Treasury. An additional $1.8 billion will be used to find new spectrum for participating TV stations. And that's good news, but expected, aside from the fact that the FCC will no longer be holding back part of the sale as a war chest with which to fight anti-consumer legal lobbying. However, the surprise of the sale was that T-Mobile won almost half of the bids. Putting up $8 billion, T-Mobile snagged the lion's share of the beachfront RF spectrum and is now in a fantastic position to offer 5G services in a spectrum that is better suited for deployment than the 700 megahertz spectrum purchased by AT&T and Verizon. However, don't expect the sale to bring immediate wireless broadband goodness to your phone. Current mobile tech doesn't support 600 megahertz, and chunks of the purchased spectrum will still be in use by TV broadcasters until early 2020. Still, with the one thing it has always lacked, spectrum, and far more goodwill saved up than any of its competitors, T-Mobile might be ready to move out of the little guy position. That does it for the blips. Next up is the bites. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. I got a message for you developers out there. Look, I understand. You're underappreciated. You're overworked. Everyone expects you to work miracles. You need to be able to deploy immediately with no downtime, all while your current deployment is still running. It's challenging, it's difficult, and yes, I'm sorry you're not going to get the praise that you deserve, but luckily, there is a tool out there that can make your job just a little bit easier, and that tool is GoCD. GoCD is an open source continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks that is the easiest way to model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. GoCD understands the difficulty of deployment in the 24/7 environment, and that's why they built their delivery server to give you a comprehensive pipeline modeling, easily configured dependencies for fast feedback, and on-demand deployment with parallel and sequential execution. Of course, if you've worked in deployment, you know that it's not just about what the tool does, but what it doesn't do. Specifically, GoCD avoids spurious builds by giving you fan-in, fan-out dependency management, so you're never wasting time with an unneeded build. Their value stream map lets you track a change from commit to deploy at a glance. So the real power is in the visibility it provides you over your end-to-end workflow. You get a complete picture and control of all of your deployments across the organization. GoCD also offers complete customization for your software's individual needs, and they will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks. Their test reporting is so thorough that it won't just tell you that your build failed a test. We've all seen those messages. It will also tell you exactly which change set broke and on what platform it started failing. You can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when you're troubleshooting a broken pipeline. It's also fantastically flexible. It supports audible deployment and lets you delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges. And it has extension points that let you connect any number of ready-to-make plugins or plugins that you write yourself. The TLDR here is that you can say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is an open-source system that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and jump into the bites. We've got a little something-something here that I know it's going to cross the realm a little bit into the political, but it's important for the enterprise because we depend so highly on H-1B visas. And this story is about the H-1B visa application system hitting its federal cap in just 5 days. Now, it was last week that the government started accepting applications for H-1B visas. that we grant to foreign tech workers. Now, remember, the H-1B visa has the stipulation that it has to be a skill set that we can't find immediately here in the United States. So these are workers that are being brought on for projects that just need to be ramped up immediately. Now, they receive trucks full of FedEx applications lined up before the applications started to come in. And by Friday, they shut the door. They said that they have already maxed out, hitting the limit of 65,000 H-1B visas that was set by Congress and an additional 20K that they reserve for applicants who have a master's degree or better. This is the fifth year in a row that the cap has been met within 5 days. Curtis, let me go to you first, because there's a lot of political charge around this right now, whether or not we need the H-1B visa program. In fact, there's been a threat that H-1B is going to be shut down, that they're going to demand that they look for qualified workers in the United States. How important is this to the enterprise? How important is this to, say, Silicon Valley in coming up with new releases on a regular schedule?
Well, I think we have to look at two different groups. One is Silicon Valley. In other words, those companies that produce software and hardware for the enterprise. And the other is the enterprises themselves. I think this is vital for the vendors, for the companies that are producing the software and hardware. And there are some very good reasons for that. One of them is, as the companies say, American universities aren't producing enough American citizen graduates of our graduate programs. And it's important to make the distinction between graduates and American citizen graduates, because if you look at most graduate schools, especially in the STEM fields, most of them have well above 50% of their graduate students as international students. And there are a number of reasons for this, the main one being financial for the universities. Most American students who come into a graduate program have to have some level of what's called support. They're on a fellowship, an assistantship, or they're getting scholarships. International students, by and large, actually pay the full out-of-state tuition plus all fees and everything else. So they are the real moneymakers for the universities. That means that they accept lots of them. We graduate lots of them. Most of them go back to their country of residence and become engineers and scientists there, but a not insignificant number apply for an H-1B visa and come back to the States because they've gotten some familiarity. Many of them have done something like an internship, and there's a relationship. If we cut out that particular avenue for professional employees, it's going to be a real problem for our technology providers. Now, for the banks and other things, most of the smaller enterprises are, in fact, making do with homegrown talent. Some of the very large ones, it's a different story, but most are using U.S.-based employees because the H-1B visa program is complicated, and you really need to have a lot of folks coming in that way to make it worthwhile just hiring the expertise. So looking at the two sides, if you are an enterprise, this is might have some impact on the products you can buy. If you are a vendor, this is a major nightmare.
Right. And Lou, I want to throw over to you for a second because, again, it's very easy to look at this and either take one position or another and say, well, yeah, we want these jobs to go to Americans, or take the position of we can't find Americans to fill these jobs. We need to fill them somehow, and either we're going to fill them here or we're just going to go offshore. We're just going to move that entire operation out of the country, which I don't think you want. There is another part of this, which is, this sounds bad, but a lot of the larger companies have already figured out a workaround to this, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, there's different tiers, right? I think Curtis was talking about colleges, you know, college students and small businesses and so on. But some of the bigger corporations around the world, you know, not to name a few, just like Amazon and Google and so on, they have locations that are basically, you know, around the globe. And there are parts of these programs that supply an avenue for those corporations. So, for instance, if I were to hire, and I have a big corporation, I have a global presence. If I hire a new person on, let's say in Switzerland, and I have a location there, they can come into work for me for, I think it's a limit of 13 months. And after that 13 months, There's a concept of an L-1 visa, and what an L-1 visa is, an intra-company transfer. And what that allows you to do is then bring that person here after 13 months. It's actually an interesting process, too, because now you're taking them in at a global location that's closer to their point of origin. The cost is less to move them there. You get a trial period for that particular employee. And then after that, a particular amount of year, a time frame, then you can bring them here. With the major costs of bringing into the United States under the L-1 scenario. And then they have a maximum of, I think, 5 to 7 years before they can renew L-1s. L-1s are a lot easier to renew. They're basically monetarily based. And then they could potentially then apply for an H-1B during that process while they're here. So they have 5 to 7 years to kind of go through that process. So that's the hard part, is some corporations can afford to do this. Some cannot. So, for instance, if you're just starting out, you're like a startup or something, you might want to take advantage, and Curtis probably knows a little bit more about this as I do, but take advantage of some of the 37 countries that are participating in the visa waiver program. So I think that's one option for some companies. If they're starting up, maybe they start in a country that does offer that capability. But again, if you have the cash, have the dough, and you have the global presence, there is kind of a workaround for this.
All right, so Curtis, let me ask you a question here. What would it take to redo the H-1B visa requirements? Because I think most everyone on both sides of the debate are saying that right now the regulations aren't great. They're not really tailored for the work that H-1B visa holders are doing. There's a lot of abuse in the system. What kind of conversation needs to take place so that more people on both sides can be happy with the outcome?
Boy, that's a good question, because this is one where you have what amounts to a small handful of companies that would love to see many more H-1B visas. The thing politically that is tricky is that the small handful of companies is able to spend quite freely on lobbying, and they do. So you have that on one side. You have on the other side people who say that there should basically be no H-1B visas at all, that if companies cannot supply their needs with U.S. residents, with citizens and legal residents, then they should just donate more money to universities and get more graduates in the programs that they need workers. The real thing, though, is that this is something that is not simply about supplying workers in a few very high-tech positions. This is wrapped up in the whole immigration issue, the whole idea of international workers coming to the U.S. There are some who feel that every time one of them gets a job, then it takes a job away from a citizen. There are others who say that we don't have enough citizens who want the work or are capable of the work. And if we want our companies to succeed, we have to allow it. I think that this is probably not going to happen outside the context of a larger immigration, which means, visa and citizenship overhaul, and boy howdy, that's a can of worms that probably isn't going to get opened in the next 2 to 3 years at least.
We've got a good conversation running in the chat room right now with Emily the Strange with Microhex and Dr. Morbius and Specs, actually, who are going back and forth on the typical arguments for H-1B visas. You've got Dr. Morbius who's saying, why would we see more STEM graduations in the United States if people know that those jobs aren't really available for them? We've got other people like Emily the Strange who's actually wondering why we've got the H-1B visa program. And then we've also got the argument of, look, this is a problem of enforcement. If you look at the guidelines for an H-1B visa, they're not supposed to be able to use the program just to find lower priced labor. They're only supposed to be able to use the program when they cannot find a suitable American applicant. However, we all know that there are companies who bend these rules. They'll change the job description just a tiny bit so that they can claim they never had an American application for that particular job, and then they fit through the H-1B system. Curtis, I want to give you the last word on this because you do have a bit more experience than the rest of us with this. Is there any sort of incentive that you can provide to an executive who is looking at the performance of his department to make him or her not decide to game the H-1B system? Or is this just going to be, when you set the rules, I'm going to find the loopholes?
It really gets back to the whole notion of scientific management. Those who work in scientific management, basically those who graduate from an MBA program and use what they learned there, look at the numbers. And it all boils down to what the numbers tell them. It's the same sort of logic that most of us who are watching or listening to this program want to apply in the sciences and engineering. You follow the numbers, and wherever the numbers lead you, that's where your decision goes. Well, for these executives, they run the numbers. And in many, many cases, the numbers say that the best way for their department, their division, their company to succeed is to maximize the number of international workers they bring in on an H-1B visa. Until something happens to change those numbers, nothing's going to happen to change the demand for H-1B visas.
Well, gentlemen, we do actually have a second bite that I've been wanting to do for a while, talking about whether or not Google needs to surrender its search results to law enforcement. But I want to save the time. I'm always a little wary of running into our guest time, and we've got a good guest today. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome to the show Mr. Sheldon DePaiva. Sheldon, am I saying that correctly?
DePaiva, that's correct.
DePaiva, there we go. You are the Director of Product Marketing for VMware Horizon. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Now, we all know VMware. VMware yeah. Horizon, what is that specifically?
So VMware Horizon is our portfolio of products that delivers what we call VDI and published applications, or our virtual desktops and published applications. So in a nutshell, if you want to deliver a desktop to any device anywhere, or you want to deliver, for example, a published application to any device anywhere, you're going to use VMware Horizon.
Right. And this is an interesting story because we started talking about VDI probably 3 years ago, very early in the cycle of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And since then, it had so much promise, and it looked like, yeah, this is what we're all going to be moving to, this idea of a managed infrastructure where people just log in to their desktop from wherever they are. It's been supplanted by everything as a service. And it's really kind of confused and muddied the waters. Where do you stand? Is VDI just another as a service, or is it something that's wholly different?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, when we look at the way end user computing is evolving, is being transformed in general, you know, we're looking at this concept of a digital workspace. And so the digital workspace, from our perspective, you know, the workspace that enables really the end user to work anywhere, right? So there are three key pieces of this, right? There's you're always going to have your business critical Windows applications and desktops. You have your mobile applications and your SaaS applications. So we view in the future, you know, that we really have to combine all of these three, make it seamless, with all tied together with identity and the ability to manage any device, whether it's a mobile device, whether it's a laptop, tie it all together in what we're calling a digital workspace. So from a kind of a comprehensive portfolio point of view, you know, we view VDI as, I'd call it one leg of a three-legged stool, right? So you have VDI, all your business-critical applications, your typical business-critical applications running on Windows, going to need that. You have your mobile applications that's going to run maybe on your smartphone or other mobile device. And then you have your SaaS applications, right? What we're providing at VMware in our end user computing business unit is a way to tie that all together seamlessly, deliver that as a modern managed digital workspace for the enterprise customer.
Let's talk about that digital workspace, because I think that's one of the key parts of the VDI solution that VMware Horizon is going to offer. It's not just, as someone might imagine, a virtualized desktop. it's very easy to see that kind of a solution as something that we're using, something that's useful, something that I can use on all my devices. But what you're talking about is something more than just taking your workspace and making it accessible over multiple devices. You are talking about integration with the other parts of infrastructure as a service. What specifically does VMware Horizon do for the VDI equation that makes it unique, that gives you a special sauce?
Yeah, definitely. So, with VMware Horizon, that's one of those integral components, right, of a digital workspace. And the key differentiator that we have as VMware, we can provide everything from the storage layer, you know, the hypervisor layer, the VDI software layer, even the monitoring. So we can provide a very tightly integrated stack in order to best deliver those virtual desktops as well as those published applications. And we have offerings to do that both on-premises, if you want to do that, or in the cloud. So you can choose to deploy in your data center if you want to do that. You can deploy in a hybrid type of configuration if you just want to own the infrastructure but manage it through the cloud, or you can deploy it fully in the cloud. So and the differentiation that we have at VMware is really, you know, being able to provide everything from again, the very bottom storage layer all the way to a stack, all up to monitoring, very tightly integrated, and then being able to consume that in the way that suits your business, right? Whether you want to do it on-premise in the cloud. And I'll say, you know, on the integration side, what we've talked about recently is our ability to deliver what we call these jump technologies, or just-in-time management platform is what we're calling it. And these for now consist of three core technologies. So I'll get a little bit into technology. We have a technology called Instant Clones based on our hypervisor that can rapidly, very, very quickly spin up virtual machines to deploy as a virtual desktop. We have a technology called App Volumes, which can very quickly populate those virtual machines with applications dynamically as they start up. And then we have a technology called User Environment Management, which basically attaches policies and personalization to these desktops, these virtual desktops. And so VMware is the only solution today that can offer these jump technologies. What does that mean ultimately? It basically means what we can deliver, or calling just-in-time desktops. What that means is that as soon as the user demands a desktop, we can spin it up. We can attach the applications, we can personalize it. So from the end user's point of view, they're getting what they see as a customized persistent desktop, but you're getting the economics of, you know, the traditional non-persistent desktops. You don't have to pre-provision, you don't have to spend all of these resources and expenditures up front. You just simply spin them up elastically on demand as you need them, and you deliver them to the end user.
I'm very happy that you brought up the idea that it's an elastic deployment, and also that you brought up a little bit of the finances, because there's a misnomer in the VDI world that VDI, the main selling point is it's cheaper. It's because it's very easy to sell to an executive saying, well, this is a cheaper solution. That's not the case, though. I mean, VDI was never designed to be the cost step down from where we are right now. It was always designed to give you, at the same price, something that was much more easy to manage, something that was a lot easier to spin up. But do you find that idea of it being lower cost still pops up in discussions when you're talking to your salespeople, when you're talking to your reps? Do they go out into the field and have people ask them, well, how is this going to drop my cost, or where is the ROI? How much of a driver is cost in the sales discussion?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, you know, sometimes a legacy from 5 years ago still holds through. It's hard to change perception sometimes. And I'd say, you know, at VMware, what we really relentlessly focused on is really taking cost as well as complexity out of VDI, because, you know, we realize that over the last few years, that's been an issue. So cost has traditionally been an issue because, you know, in the days before flash storage or even hybrid flash storage systems, you know, storage was typically a pain point for VDI, because if you can imagine like 1,000 desktops hitting a storage system, that places a lot of load on the storage system. And traditionally, you know, before flash, storage systems had a hard time keeping up with that. You know, but that was maybe like 3-5 years ago. Now we have flash storage systems, we have hyper-converged storage systems that have both dramatically reduce the cost of VDI as well as the complexity. So if you look at a modern stack for VDI today, you know, we talked about a tightly integrated stack, and you can consider, for example, a hyperconverged infrastructure, which is a marriage made in heaven for something like VDI if you want to deploy it on premises, right? You have now compute storage very tightly coupled. You can deploy flash as part of that. You can very easily meet your IOPS requirements. Plus, from an infrastructure simplification point of view, now you can manage everything through something like vCenter. So from a management point of view, from a simplification point of view, we've done a lot of work to eliminate that complexity, you know, which also in turn removes cost, right? Both through modern technologies available and the management simplicity. But I'll say, you know, to your point, I think there is still a perception that cost is an issue. And we've done numerous studies on this topic, and so we have, you know, very detailed analysis from third parties such as IDC that actually demonstrate if you just look at certain aspects of VDI, then it may, you know, you may have questions about the value proposition. And if you're just looking, for example, at the capital expenditure, or just looking, for example, at the endpoint, right? So, okay, well, I have this laptop, I can switch it up for a thin client or a zero client. You know, that's not where the bulk of the value proposition comes from. Now, there is some value, there is some benefit you'll get there, because if you're deploying a thin client or a zero client, you know, you can extend the refresh cycle maybe for another 2 or 3 years. So you get, you know, some benefit from that. But the majority of the value proposition, if you're doing like a total TCO analysis on VDI, really comes from two things. It comes from one, the business productivity impact. So this is, again, you know, the ability of empowering your users to really consume things in a mobile fashion, being able to consume things anywhere from any device, you know, eliminating the hassles of logging, long login times, and so on. So that's one aspect. The other big aspect is in the simplification from an IT perspective, right? If you take, for example, imagine your business and you've got 1,000 users to support, right? If you're doing it the traditional way, you have 1,000 images, but what if instead of 1,000 images, you could just have one image, right? That what if questions gets folks starting to think about, yeah, wouldn't that be much simpler to manage if I had to manage one image versus 1,000, right? So you can imagine the IT simplification in terms of managing all of these endpoints that VDI brings to the table. So, you know, the business productivity is huge. The IT IT benefits are huge. And then, you know, a third factor beyond the kind of endpoint hardware benefits is the risk mitigation. You know, very often it's kind of human nature that you don't look at sometimes the risks that might happen. You know, we all put them off. But what about security breaches? You know, what about disasters and so on? So that makes up a good chunk of the value proposition as well. Because remember that with VDI, you're running everything safely and securely in the data center. You're completely eliminating a whole set of security threat vectors, right? If you have a zero client, you're eliminating a whole bunch of security threat vectors from there. If you're using our technology with network micro-segmentation, you're wrapping everything in a secure network bubble, so you're eliminating a whole bunch of security threats from there. Your data is safe and secure in the data center, so that's good. And then on top of that, you know, you're running on very highly resilient, highly available systems. So in the event of a disaster, you can use VDI to keep your business moving forward, right? So that becomes an important third bucket, what I would call it in terms of the core value propositions behind VDI. So in terms of, you know, when you look at VDI, what I'd say is, you know, you're absolutely right. I think very oftentimes people just kind of look at the endpoint and say, well, it's not that much savings I'm going to get. It's not really worth the hassle. And maybe I'll get, you know, like $100 savings a year if I, from a, just a device basis, if I swap it out with a thin client or your client or cheaper endpoint device. But, you know, and our analysis shows that for a typical enterprise customer, and it's been validated by firms such as IDC, they can get close to $4,000 saving or return on investment per device per year for the employees.
All right, let's actually break it down here. Let's give something for our audience, because a lot of them are in IT departments looking at this right now. They're looking at maybe using this in the future. For them, let's put aside a lot of the buzzwords. Let's put aside a lot of the PR and actually talk about how it's going to affect their workflow. A typical IT worker is doing a deployment for a new employee, and so he or she needs to make sure that they've got images of the new worker's desktop and needs to make sure that they've got RDP set up properly so that they can get in when they're not at the office. They need to set up their tablets and their phones so that they can access the network properly with the right authentication. What would you do for them? How would you simplify their workflow? Because remember, along with all of that, they also have to handle the security concerns. They have to handle the deployment and the rollout concerns. They also have to handle the maintenance concerns. How does Horizon make their job easier?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, from a end user computing perspective, if you're trying to onboard a whole, a new user or a set of new users, what you can do, first of all, from an endpoint perspective, you know, you don't have to worry as much about the endpoints because depending on what the business standardizes on, you can issue thin clients. You can, if you're pursuing a BYO strategy, you can let the end user deploy their own device, or you can just very easily standardize. So you don't have to worry as much about the endpoint device. You don't have to do a lot of customization imaging on every single user that needs to be provisioned. Now, from a centralized administrative perspective, I think it comes down to, again, just drastically reducing the number of images to one or just a few. So now, the IT administrator, if they've got VDI rolled out, they already have the set of images that they need to deploy to their organization, whether it's one or maybe a couple for different lines of businesses. With Horizon, they already have what are called, with app volumes, we call app stacks. So for every line of business, they can define, for example, a base set of application that goes to every user. For the finance workers, they can define a set of applications that just goes to the finance team. For an engineering organization, for example, if they're CAD engineers, they can add, for example, AutoCAD or some other 3D type of applications, some architectural applications that they might need. Basically all the administrator does is say, okay, well, you know, give them this golden image from the base OS, give them this app stack for the applications that they need. You can assign a user profile as policies. For example, you can have predefined policies in terms of, you know, what access they have to the networks internally, what happens when they're outside a network, and this all follows the user from. So it becomes very, very simple from an administrative point of view to roll out a new user. All they do is basically assign the image, the app stacks, the user policies, and then the user is able to access this desktop from any device that they have.
Yeah, single point authentication to get into a consistent desktop across all platforms and all screens. That's actually not bad. Let's move forward a little bit. There's a lot of background that we can cover when my co-hosts come back in, but I do want to talk a little bit about Blast. Blast is something that we've just started peeking at. Can you tell me exactly what it is?
Yeah, definitely. So Blast Extreme is a protocol that we've been working on at VMware with Horizon. And, you know, what it is a protocol that connects from the endpoint to the data center. So all the traffic that goes across the network is handled through Blast. We came up with this protocol called Blast Extreme, and initially with the previous version of Horizon. And what we've done since then is extend that with an adaptive transport. So actually in the video you're watching right now, on the left-hand side, you can see, you know, Blast Extreme without the latest edition of the adaptive transport. On the right, you can see Blast Extreme with the adaptive transport. And, you know, when everything was fine at 200 megabits per second, a decent amount of bandwidth, everything is great. But now look what happens. As soon as you go to what we'll call a non-ideal networks, right? So now all of a sudden you cut down the bandwidth to 5 megabits per second. You have a lot of packet loss, around 10%. You know, you might have this in a coffee shop or very long distances. You can see on the left-hand side, it's pretty much crawled to a slideshow, whereas on the right-hand side, it still gives you a good user experience with the adaptive transport. So, you know, what we've done is we talked about VDI and our vision really to deliver their desktops and applications on any device, anywhere. What we've done with adaptive transport is essentially expand the use cases. So now, even if you're in a non-ideal location doing high-power graphics, watching videos, doing a 3D CAD application, you know, you might be in a coffee shop, You might be, for example, across a continent. You might be have colleagues across continents working on a CAD application, engineering application, or even in a different continent. Now you can still get a good user experience so that you can continue to use those high power graphics applications anywhere. So even on non-ideal networks now, we've added what we call an adaptive transport. It's a UDP-based transport. It has a lot of great technology under the hood, you know, forward error correction, new algorithms, predictive algorithms that adapt to these non-ideal network conditions and then automatically adjust to still give you a great user experience.
Sheldon, I want to go ahead and bring in my my co-host here because they've been chomping at the bit. I can see them in the little preview monitor. Lou, let's start with you because you've got, again, because of your position, you've got a unique perspective on this. Why aren't we all using VDI right now? This kind of technology has been around for a while, and it's been getting better and better. And as Sheldon has pointed out, the advantages are incredible, especially for someone who's in IT who has to manage these instances for users. So why is VDI still what I would consider a very difficult sell for what should be a no-brainer?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things we see, and this is all dependent on the industry too. So a lot of the different parts of the industries, like for instance, financial institutes, they tend to be slow adoption of anything, let alone things like this. And I think the important thing to focus on is sometimes applications, they don't necessarily always play nice in a VDI kind of standpoint, whether it's virtualization on the app itself or desktop. And so some companies require that they are certifying all of their legacy applications to work. In fact, all of their newer applications to work in this particular environment. And sometimes they don't, or sometimes they do and they're not optimal. And so some of the newer technologies that are coming out are helping older legacy applications work in that type of environment. But again, if there's not an easy way for these companies to certify, they don't go all in from that aspect of things. Another kind of way of floating from the other side is that a lot of some of the newer technologies in places like Windows 10 and Windows 2016, they offer, you know, the kind of, like you were saying, some of these new enhanced adaptive approaches, technologies. And so most companies, like, for instance, I'll give you another example, banks and financial institutes, they tend to be very slow to upgrade, especially in an on-premise standpoint. And so they can't necessarily take advantage of these new enhancements that come along with the operating systems. And so, again, some very slow adaption rate. So hopefully in years later from now, as they spend the money to upgrade to these latest servers and these latest transports, they can start to adapt VDI a little bit more.
Yeah. And actually, I wanted to ask you about that. What is Windows 10 doing to the VDI landscape? Because Windows 10 supposedly is better for this sort of thin client application. It's supposed to be more flexible. Is that going to speed adoption at all, do you believe, Sheldon?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we did a survey last year on with the customers on the top end user computing concerns or initiatives that they were looking at. And Windows 10 adoption was rated by about 65% of them as one of the top three initiatives that they were going to be looking at. So it's definitely top of mind to our customers, and simply because of the fact that, look, Microsoft has said it's going to be the last operating system, right? So at some point, every business is going to have to switch to Windows 10. So in our conversations with customers, what it comes down to is really, okay, they're definitely thinking about Windows 10. They're thinking about how they can get to Windows 10. And really, it's an inflection point when they start thinking about Windows 10 in terms of, okay, well, I know I'm going to have to switch to Windows 10. So it's a good time for them to really evaluate their end user computing strategy, right? So for many of these customers, it's a chance to say, hey, you know, if they're physical, maybe now that it gives them that little nudge, right, to say, okay, maybe I should think about virtualizing. And, you know, I'll give you an example as an anecdote. We had a customer recently, a large global retailer, actually, who was making this decision. They had to switch to Windows 10, but they had this investment, this huge investment, tens of millions of dollars in their existing endpoints at all their stores, right? They have 3,000 stores, 20 plus countries, and they would have had to upgrade all of these endpoints for Windows 10 because Windows 10 requires some better hardware. So what they decided to do is like, okay, well, maybe instead of, you know, making the investment and upgrading all of that now, We can take this opportunity to centralize our deployments by virtualizing, so that way we can deploy Windows 10 anywhere on any device. We can save on the tens of millions of dollars of investment that we would normally have to do. Plus, we can modernize our entire point of sale system. So what I mean by that is now they can deploy lower cost clients for point of sale, plus upgrade the customer experience by deploying things like iPads and enabling just a better point of sale experience, right? So those are some of the examples we're seeing really when it comes to Windows 10. Customers, definitely it's top of mind for them. They need to figure out how to get to Windows 10. A lot of the customers are coming to us because, you know, we can provide a pretty comprehensive solution for Windows 10. Whether they want to stay physical, we can help them manage that. What I'm hearing a lot about is, okay, now maybe it's time for me to go virtual. How do I do that? And they're starting that journey to virtualize because of Windows 10, and that's top of mind for them.
All right. Now, Sheldon, let me ask you what the typical VDI lifecycle is going to look like for you. Again, let's use a Windows 10 example since it is the last operating system. If someone is going to do a deployment, what does it look like to consider the deployment, to start setting it up, to actually do the deployment, maintain it, and then when do they look at turning it over?
Yeah, I think in terms of VDI deployments, if you take an on-premises deployment, typical deployment can be, somewhere 8 to 12 months. It starts with, we have set tools to help you get set up with that. And of course, if you're doing it in the cloud, by the way, it's a lot faster. You can pretty much, swipe your credit card and go. But to start, you would do an assessment. So we have SaaS tools that can help you with that. It'll take a look at your system, analyze it, tell you, what decision points you might need to make with regards to VDI. I think from there, specifically with Windows 10, we look at it as a kind of a three-phase approach with Windows 10. So first, it's always good to test and certify applications. If you're running, especially if you're like a healthcare firm, you have these very critical applications that you're going to run. You can essentially, run those applications inside. You can test those and certify those applications inside of virtualized Windows 10. So you can test and certify applications. You can enable your end users. So before you kind of blast it out to everybody, you can give them a nice sandbox to play with so that they can stay productive even when it's rolled out. And then finally, when you roll it out, when you're rolling out, you can very quickly and easily roll it out at scale because, again, you're basically rolling it out from one or a few images and you can roll out very quickly to the endpoints. Now, as far as maintenance, over the life cycle, I think every company, every business will have to look at their strategy for doing that. Typically, in VDI deployments, most of our customers don't update that frequently. So I think every business will have to look at, what are their needs are? Do they want to stay on the more frequent updates that the current branch is offering? Do they want to move to a long-term branch? The good thing about VDI is that, depending, we can provide the solution that suits their business for either of those. So if they want to stay more current, they can do that. Because remember, even if they're updating frequently, you're only updating one or a few images, right? So the tax of doing that is lower. If you want to, for some businesses, for example, they have these endpoint devices that are very static, right? They have a very specific purpose, so they don't need to really update that very frequently. Well, with VDI, you can do that as well. So you have a very simplified process of really maintaining and staying current on Windows 10 overall throughout the life cycle.
All right, so that's talking about a typical life cycle. But Curtis, I know you had a question about deploying very popular applications from different vendors, how you make sure that you stay compliant, how you make sure that your licenses are up to date, and how you make sure that you're deploying them efficiently across VDI. What are the concerns you would bring to Sheldon?
Well, I think one of the things that I'm curious about, obviously, if a corporation is happy with their basic desktop operating system infrastructure, it's almost impossible to get them to move to the same desktop just in VDI. But I'm curious, do you see a lot of VDI deployments that are instigated by a move to, say, a new ERP system or some new massive enterprise application backbone? It seems to me that might be a good opportunity for moving to VDI, especially when so many of these, and I'm thinking of SAP in particular, place an emphasis on how well their applications work when they're front-ended on a mobile device. As you were talking about earlier, one of the great benefits of VDI is that if you have an iPad Pro, you can do a very credible job of showing a Windows desktop there. Do you see a tie-in there with your customers?
Yeah, if I understand the question correctly, you know, from an application perspective, that's a big driver, right? So ultimately, it's all about the applications, right? Every business, ultimately, we're doing this because applications are king. We want to provide access to right applications for employees to stay productive. And many of our wins are actually driven by a few key applications, right? And then, of course, it depends by vertical. But in healthcare, for example, that's a perfect case, right? There are a few applications in healthcare that healthcare, you know, clinicians need access to for point of care service, right? And those applications, they typically need to be certified for desktop virtualization application publishing. But that often is a big driver to enable access to those applications from anywhere. That's often a big driver for a desktop virtualization or published application deployment. So, for example, you can imagine, you know, in a clinic, for example, a healthcare professional, you know, would need to go to a patient, maybe show them some information, switch to a terminal, enter some prescription information, switch to another diagnostic tool, and take essentially their desktop with them and access to those specific healthcare vertical applications, right? So for those types of deployments, you know, very certainly, that's a big driver that we see for VDI deployments. So when I say VDI, I'm going to include both full virtual desktops, as well as, you know, centrally publishing applications out to the end users on a per application basis. And that's true, to your point, I would say it's sometimes very hard, right? If things are working well, users are happy, they have that desktop, it's hard often to make a change. So specific applications, a need for an upgrade, an update for specific applications, a big driver. We just talked about Windows 10, right? If organizations are looking at how to deploy Windows 10, that's a big driver. What I'd also say is now, you know, what we're increasingly seeing is where we're talking about the bigger picture of the digital workspace, right? Is how companies are asking about how do I provide my Windows desktops and my Windows applications as part of this digital workspace, because they know they have to get there. They know if they have to tie it all together down the road. And that, you know, at a strategic level, we're increasingly seeing, so this is at the CIO, CEO level, right? We're increasingly seeing those kind of conversations about, you know, maybe this is the way I want to go forward when I want to get to that modern digital workspace, right? So how do I make sure I give my end users access to those Windows desktops and applications?
Sheldon, we are very quickly running out of time here, but I do want to give you a last word here, and perhaps you can make it a bit more concrete for our audience. VDI is a great set of technologies, and the way that VMware Horizon is making it easier for you to do your integrations is hopefully a very good step towards making it more ubiquitous. But at the moment, there are going to be deployments that are good for VDI and deployments that are not. How would you make the difference? What's the delineation for you? What is the ideal deployment, and what are those deployments that maybe should just wait a little longer for the technology to mature?
Yeah, great question. So I think, you know, I'll say this by how we see our customers deploying VDI. I think there's definitely a gray zone where, you know, both VDI as well as physical deployments can play the same role. If the business or the end customer, I think what it comes down to is the end user, right? If the end user really needs a very, very customized experience, they want to own that endpoint device, they want to be able to customize it to their heart's content, you know, deploy whatever applications that they want to deploy. I think for them, you know, staying physical might be the option that they want that they want to keep going down. For customers that need to make sure that they want to get more centralized, they want to have a little bit more security, a little bit more compliance, especially in certain key verticals. So, for example, healthcare, you know, finance, education, those kind of verticals. For them, you know, it's very important to dramatically simplify administration, to have a little bit more security, improve the security posture, make sure that they're compliant with industry regulations. Then I think for those sorts of customers, you know, the VDI is going to be a great solution for them.
I love that. That's, if you're worried about compliance, then you need to look no further than VDI. I think that's the tagline we could leave them with. Sheldon, I want to thank you so very much for being with us today. This is a topic that's been a long time coming, and it's nice to have an expert from VMware Horizon come on. If you could please tell the folks who are watching and listening right now where they can find you, where they can find VMware Horizon, where they can find out more about what VDI might be able to do for their network.
Sure. You can reach me on Twitter, Sheldon_DePaiva that's actually at Sheldon_DePaiva is my Twitter handle. If you want to go to VMware.com, simply go to the Horizon page. There's lots of great information right there on our webpage where you can go for more detailed info on VMware Horizon.
Fantastic. Sheldon, again, it was a pleasure to have you here on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And folks, I'm afraid you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 out-of-work RDP installations. We want to thank everyone who made this show possible. Of course, to Sheldon, but especially to my co-host, without whom I would not want to do the show. Let's start with Curtis Franklin. Curtis, where can people find you and your work and hopefully news about your healing wrist?
Well, Padre, the wrist is coming along nicely. I'm very happy. And next weekend, the weekend of April 20th, 21st, 22nd, I'm going to be down in Orlando running in the Dark Side 10K and half marathon. I know that there are lots of quiet listeners who run as well. So if you're going to be down there running for the Dark Side, hit me on Twitter, KG4GWA. Would love to say hello. In the meantime, you can find the things that I'm writing at Light Reading and Enterprise Cloud News. I'm enjoying doing that. And my launch of a new site has been moved slightly. It's going to be coming in mid-May rather than mid-April, but that just gives us time to make it all the better. So much more still to come here on Twyatt and everywhere else.
Thank you, Curtis. Now, actually, Kevin, could you go back to that picture of him in Light Reading? Because I was just thinking that that pic profile that you have up there, it makes you look like you're the one who triggered all those sirens in Dallas. You look a little dark tipperish. In fact, I'm a little scared now.
My tone generating capabilities are well and widely known.
Folks,
what can I say?
That is the face of a man who's up to mischief. Just FYI. FYI.
I solemnly promise I am up to no good.
A man who I know is up to no good, but in a good way, is Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, of course, we know we can find you at Microsoft, but where else can we find your work, and what are you up to these days?
Yeah, absolutely. You can always find my stuff at serum.dynamics.com, but also check out, there's some cool conferences coming up. I think the Summit in EMEA, which is like the kind of the Dynamics conference in EMEA, which debuts a lot of stuff that we're working on and coming up with. And of course, check out, Dynamics 365 coming out with some new stuff soon with our latest and greatest release. It's kind of a milestone pivoting release. So we're working real hard on that. So check out that soon. And you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM.
Lou, Curtis, thank you again for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, I salute you. And also, I salute you, the person who is watching, the person who is listening. Without you, we don't have an audience. Without an audience, we don't have This Week in Enterprise Tech. You've been with us for so long. And we want to make sure that it's easy for you to get your Twyatt fix. All you got to do is go to our show page at twit.tv/Twyatt. That's T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find all of our episodes, so you can download the ones that you've missed, as well as the notes if you want to look at the links to the stories that we've covered in our episodes. And also, most importantly, a little subscribe drop down. You can get the version of your choice, be it audio, video, or high definition video, into your device of choice automatically each week. This is one of the best ways to support Twyatt to make sure that we can continue to bring you enterprise goodness week after week. And it's also a good way to stay connected with the community. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll find out what I'm doing, including going to Giants games when it's raining, which is actually a lot of fun, even though they lost that game. Go figure. Two years ago, I went to 14 home games, and they won every one. And this year, I've gone to one, and they lost it. So that kind of tells you the kind of year we're going to have. Anyway, go to twitter.com/PadreSJ and follow along. Thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible. Of course, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue to do Twiet all these years. To our engineers, Alex and Kara. To my fantastic TD, Kevin. I think this is the time of the show where we always talk to you. Can you tell the folks at home what it is that you do here at Twit TV?
I make sure all the different flavors of hot chocolate are sorted in order so people know what kind of hot chocolate they're getting.
Ah, I see. Okay, well, it's time for you to answer the question with knowledge from the show. Oh, it's always a chance for you to get some redemption, Kevin. All you have to do this week is really quickly, within 1 second, tell me, what does VDI stand for?
Verizon Horizon.
No. It was so close, Kevin, so close. Maybe next time it was virtual desktop infrastructure, which you should know because it's on the dock like 15 times.
I would have got that if I had more than 1 second.
Maybe next week. Again, folks, thanks to everyone, especially to Cheebert, our super producer, who is the man who's responsible for getting us all the guests. Be sure to follow him on Twitter as well. And until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.